everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, economics, current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the economic bubble when we come back. You know, the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And now our national leaders have subscribed to a plan created by the Club of Rome. It's fostered by the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, and a whole host and plethora of other lesser policy-making think tanks. And that is to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. Now, that's correct, 90% over the next 50 years. So let's not delude ourselves into believing that we're going to stop these mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians in their insane scheme to enslave the world and impose a worldwide tyranny, a thing they call the New World Order, upon all of us. But you and I do not have to participate in our own demise, and we don't have to help them, finance them, or stand helplessly by and do nothing either. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and to stop following after all these crazy scientists and philosophers, these preachers and politicians, and let you and I prepare to live through and survive this new world order in Global 2000. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And remember, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about subsistence and survival. What do you do to prepare for a calamity like the New World Order, this new scheme that the politicians have dreamed up to meld all of the nations of the world into a one-world economy, all the races and nations of people into a single worldwide government, a plan, a dream that was God himself put the kibosh on at the Tower of Babel. They had the same idea about 4,000 years ago, and God came along, confounded our languages, and scattered us over the face of the earth until more modern times, and now we're back to this Tower of Babel prospect or program again, where we want to get all the nations together. We want to control population, number one. After all, population control is the number one item on the agenda of the New World Order. There are too many people in the world consuming too much of its resources. Therefore, we've got to limit population growth. Now, in China, they have done a pretty remarkable job of doing that. They're working hard to accomplish that goal in India, leaving aside the concept that there is a God and that God will limit population when the time is right. After all, he's the one that told us to be fruitful and multiply. He must have had a reason for doing that. Obviously, God made a mistake, though, and we humans are now in the process of fixing or correcting God's error, called population control. Now, as this new world order is being ordered, being put into effect, it's going to kill a lot of people. And you can begin to see that the world's population explosion, coupled with the economic slowdown around the world, with the economic fiat currencies that are extant worldwide. By the fact that the world's food supply is down to 38 days. Now, I say that that's critical. You know, everybody in the world should have a minimum one-year supply of food on hand from harvest to harvest. A prudent man would have a two-year supply on hand in case there was a harvest failure. If you were following the scriptures, you would have a three-year food supply on hand, your normal year-to-year. Then you'd have your prudent supply, that's a one-year supply. And then once every 7 years, you would have a three-year supply to carry you through the year of release. And then once every 50 years, you would have a four-year supply to carry you through the year of release and the Jubilee. The world in 1970 was down to about a 70-day supply, a little over 2 months. Today, it's down to a little over 1 month. Boys and girls, I say that's scary, especially when we look at Revelation chapter 6, because Revelation 6 has the four horsemen of the apocalypse, of which one of them is famine. Now, famines have killed billions of people throughout the history of the world. Wars have killed billions of people throughout our history. But the Bible talks about an end-time catastrophe in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, Revelation 6, Deuteronomy 28, and Leviticus 26. Those chapters describe an end-time catastrophe that Jesus of Nazareth said would rival, if not exceed, the death or the pain, suffering, and anguish. I'm not quite sure what he had in mind there in Matthew 24, when he described it as being equal to Noah's flood, which killed all but 8 people in the world. Now, I would contend that that's pretty heavy duty. Now, nobody prepares for the Great Tribulation. I mean, I've never heard anybody doing that. The Mormons are the one group of people that are preparing for an event. And while they don't call it the Great Tribulation, at least I've never seen or heard any of them call it the Great Tribulation, I think that's really what they're in practical fact preparing for. The concept of having a 7-year supply of food, and then knocked down to a 4-year supply, then a 2-year supply, then a 1-year supply, then a 3-day supply, tells me that they're heading in the wrong direction. But in 1974, a guy by the name of Howard Ruff, who is a Mormon, wrote a book. In this book, he called it Famine and Survival in America. And I don't know if he thought about how profound his book was going to be, because in 1974, when he wrote this book, it appeared like that the collapse of the world's economies was in the offing. America had just gone off of gold, and we'd gone onto a fiat currency. And he said, you know, there's a cause and effect relationship. Paul Volcker raised interest rates to 21%, put America into a recession, and straightened out that impending collapse of the 1970s and staved it off for another 25 or 30 years. In the year 2005, this chapter that is called Famine and Survival in America, The Bursting Balloon, couldn't have been more prophetic if the guy had been sent from God himself. Because the exact same problems that we're facing today, we were facing in the 1970s. But the methodology that we're following today to solve that problem, not higher interest rates, it's lower interest rates. It's not reining in the production of money, it's print more money. Now let me share with you Ruff's view from 1974. I say that it's just as up-to-date in the year 2005 as if he had written it last week. He says, the Federal Reserve has a vested interest in continued government budget deficits. But why is this? Because it is a privately owned banking system whose principal income is derived from loaning the government money to finance its deficits. In 1971, the government sent over $18 billion into the pockets of the bankers who own the Federal Reserve banking system as interest payments on government securities owned by the banks, the interest on the national debt. and the Federal Reserve is not subject to audit or any kind of accounting. Attempts by Congress to pass such laws have been beaten back. It is contrary to the self-interest of the Fed for the government to reduce spending. Number two, to increase taxes. In classic economic theory, this is supposed to pull money out of circulation, reduce spending, and the competitive market prices drives prices down. But its actual net effect is to force merchants to increase prices so that they can have a net profit after their increased taxes. And it backfires by increasing the demands of labor for wage and benefit increases to cover their taxes, which forces up prices so your dollar buys less. You can't put out a fire by pouring kerosene on it. Three, tighten the money supply and increase interest rates. Have you noticed that the Fed's first choice of inflation-fighting tools is to increase their own income with higher interest rates? And as I write this, the prime lending rate is 11.5%, and there is a real credit crunch. This means that everyone who needs some kind of financing or equity capital has trouble getting it. Well, everybody except the government. And as interest rates for business go up, it is simply passed on to you, the consumer. Higher mortgage rates prevailing in July of 1974, 10%. That means that you would pay $23,000 more in interest over the life of a 30-year mortgage on a $35,000 house than you would have before interest rates started up in November of 1973, 7%, just 9 months earlier. And also, the builder has higher construction loan costs, which, of course, he adds to the price of the house. And we call this fighting inflation. And number four, wage and price controls. Wage and price controls do not work and never have. This only builds up explosive pressures for upward movement. It creates shortages and forces the producers into bankruptcy, which reduces the supply and enforces price increases and or shortages with a high-priced black market. Now, there is a solution. It is the only solution. And the only solution that will really reduce inflation is to reduce government spending and to retire the national debt. This, however, means millions of government workers will be put out of jobs, government subsidies eliminated, government contracts canceled, and the worst depression in our history. No politician wants to be blamed for this, and the Democrats have been running against Herbert Hoover since 1930. But a worse depression will come eventually through runaway inflation as we pass the point of no return, where stopping it is so painful that no one has the guts to take the necessary action. There are only two choices, a horrible depression or a devastating runaway inflation. In either instance, the growing, processing, and distribution of food could become next to impossible. So if inflation doesn't scare you, then let's let Harry Brown describe a runaway inflation in his book, You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis, published in 1972. Brown said, "I believe that we can create a scenario to show the development of inflation over the length of its cycle. The scenario encompasses the histories of many past inflations, along with some speculation concerning what might happen if inflation is continued to its ultimate conclusion here in the United States." First of all, he says, over a period of years, retail prices go up only gradually. And if the government hasn't been too ambitious in its programs, during that time, price increases are small enough that they're noticeable only on an annual basis. Number two. However, the inevitable compounding of inflation leads to a point where consumers become concerned about constantly rising prices. And in addition, the gold supply may be jeopardized by foreign claims. Number three, if the government respects these market reactions, it will show some frugality. It will cut its spending and diminish the inflation. This will result in a recession. If the government fails to heed the market signals and tries to avoid the recession, inflation will continue in earnest. Number four, if the cycle is allowed to continue, there will be a period, perhaps of several years, during which inflation will be a national concern. Prices will be rising steadily and substantially. There will be concern about the losses suffered by people on fixed incomes, but nothing will be done to halt the inflation. Number five. Eventually, inflation will be noticeable on a monthly basis instead of just annually. A consumer may notice that an item that he buys regularly has gone up in price several times during a few months. If that happens with a number of things that he buys, inflation has reached an advanced stage. I'm going to pause right here. Do you remember the Magombo guru? He mentioned the very same thing. He said the prices on corn and food and various other items had increased month over month. Bernanke of the Federal Reserve in New York said, if necessary to prevent deflation, we will dump money out of helicopters. So we're going to opt for runaway inflation, boys and girls. You can bet on it. Number six, if the government heeds this belated warning, it will finally capitulate to the general market and stop the inflation. This, of course, will initiate a full-scale depression. Now, we went through that in the 1930s. Nobody wants that. Everybody tells me, oh God, we don't want another depression. Well, and the alternative is runaway inflation. Number seven, acceleration of the cycle. If the government is unwilling to allow that to happen, it will continue the inflation despite the warnings from the market. Then the flight from paper money takes place in earnest, and many individuals will rush to get rid of their dollars before they depreciate further. Exchanging their dollars for gold, silver, or gold-backed foreign currencies or commodities usable to the buyer in the future. Let me pause right there. Put my little check mark there in the margin. Let me point out to you that in World War II, had we known of the shortages that we were going to face in 1939, 40, and 41, I think more of us would have prepared for it. And as a result of it, we would have had more coffee. We would have had more sugar, more spices on the shelf. Now, we all had a pantry and we all had a year's supply of food. At least when I was a kid in our neck of the woods, people lived from year to year. Today, they live from day to day, going to the supermarket once, twice, or three times a week to buy their supplies, just a day or two or three at a time. At least in the 1930s and 40s, we were prepared from one year to the next. Today, we're down to a 38-day supply. Now, boys and girls, that's the average worldwide. You have a 38-day supply of food on hand. You need a minimum 365, a desirable 2-year supply, a prudent 3-year supply, and if you were getting really ready for something that was serious, you'd have a 4-year supply with the means of maintaining that 4-year supply, which would be a garden or it would be some kind of a mechanism by which you could produce food and fiber. Now, number eight, the original compounding effect at the government level now reaches crisis proportions. Government employees won't settle for the same old wages even with a nominal cost of living increase built in. And inflation has reached the point where prices of the supplies the government needs have reached extraordinary levels so that the government must pay higher wages and prices immediately. And it can do this only by inflating the currency at a faster rate. Number nine, naturally, the new inflation makes everything even worse. Prices rush upward. Weekly price changes become the rule at the retail level. Soon products formerly costing a few dollars are priced in the hundreds of dollars. Number 10, government is caught on a merry-go-round that it can no longer stop. Tax collectors, policemen, and bureaucrats who once received $15,000 a year, for example, are now paid $500 a day. But even that isn't enough for them to keep up with skyrocketing prices. Most of them could do something else for $1,000 a day, even without special skills. To keep them and to purchase supplies, the government must offer market prices and wages, because if it doesn't, the government itself will collapse for lack of tax collectors and policemen. Soon, number 11, soon prices increase every day, and the prices of the simplest items are measured in thousands and millions of dollars. And again, the government must step up its inflation in order to hold on to its employees. Number 12, eventually price change by the hour. Workers demand to be paid twice a day or more in order to rush out to spend the paper money before it depreciates any further. The government, still caught in a dilemma of its own making, must print the money even faster, or it will go under. Million-dollar bills come off the presses in the quantities that $1 bills were printed a year earlier, and the bills may be printed on only one side to save time and ink. Even though the government wouldn't stop the inflation earlier because it wanted to avoid a depression, there is depression, along with runaway inflation. For business as usual cannot be carried on during a runaway inflation. It's too difficult to trade and produce. Factories close from inability to keep up with the inflation. 14. And by this time, the government is clearly licked. It must halt the printing press orgy and return to sanity. There's only one way that this can be done, and it has to introduce a new currency that is backed by gold or silver and can be converted into gold or silver by anyone. Nothing less would give the new money any stability, and of course the old currency would be totally worthless. This isn't a new problem to savers. They will have lost the value of their savings long before. Now, if the government introduces a new gold-backed currency, the economy can begin the long road back to normality. There will be gigantic losses to be liquidated, plants to be reopened, jobs to be found, and all that must be done with less efficient communications and mobility than would have been available had the government surrendered to the marketplace earlier. Now we come to what's known as the ultimate disaster. Now I want to pause here and make an editorial comment because this isn't something new. We went through this hyperinflation in 1783 when the continental currency collapsed. We've been through depressions, recessions, and monetary crises about every 10 to 20 years from the founding of our nation in 1787 until today. It's nothing new. As long as we use unjust weights and balances, paper money, mortgages, interest, as long as we violate the basic 15 laws of economics contained in the scripture, we're going to have these kinds of economic problems. Now, if you want to stop, if you want to get off that merry-go-round, you go back to practicing gold and silver, hard money, just weights and balances. I know it's a wild new concept, but we used to do that in America, and when we did that, when we practiced gold and silver, when we practiced just weights and balances, we Americans were the most prosperous, well-fed, we were the envy of the world. And then when we went on to a fiat currency like all the nations around us, which has always been our watchword, we want to be like all the nations around us, we've gone into the same kinds of problems that all the nations around us have always had. Inflation, losses, big government, tyranny, you name it, we've got it. And it's worse in 2005 than it was in the 1970s when Howard Ruff penned these words. But he's not through yet. He says, but what if the government has no gold or silver with which to back this new currency? And what if it has long since squandered all of its real wealth? And what if there's no foreign government or others who will lend it the gold necessary? Well, then clearly saving the dollar will no longer be in the interest of any foreign government at that point. In that case, the monetary system will collapse totally. There will be no way that individuals can use billions of dollars depreciating hourly to trade and exchange for necessities. The currency will be totally worthless because no one will be willing to accept it. The currency will fail, and with it the government, for the government will have no resources with which to pay for what it needs to survive. And that's precisely what happened to the Weimar Republic in 1923. Precisely. All right. So we couldn't learn from our own experience in 1783 with the collapse of our continental currency. We couldn't learn from the depression of the 1930s. So we're going to repeat these same historical mistakes in 2005 or 2010, however long it takes now for this to work its way through the system and to give us the results that we see in Argentina and Brazil and Peru and Ecuador, Bolivia. Every country in the world has done this in the 20th century. Paper money doesn't last forever. We Americans hold the record. We have been using this paper money on a national basis since 1914. We hold the world's record for keeping a paper money in existence. the longest. And you can see where it's heading in the year 2005. All right, now there's more. Throughout the marketplace, normal exchange will come to a halt. Chaos will reign as all the normal trappings of civilization as we know it disappear. There will be no law, no order, no communications other than verbal, no companies to turn to for help. Number 16. Exchanges can occur then only on a barter basis, such as trading a loaf of bread for a gallon of gas. But precious little bartering can take place because it's practically impossible for a large company to employ thousands of workers on a barter basis. So who is going to produce the loaf of bread or the gallon of gas after current supplies have been exhausted? Only what's been hoarded in advance can be bartered away. And there's the key. What are you going to have to barter? Now let me suggest this. Some years back, the price of coffee went down to $4 a can. You know those 39-ounce cans, you know, 34 to 39-ounce cans, the big ones? Went down to $4. Well, I bought a bunch of them. Well, a year or so went by, and one day the price of coffee went up to about $6. And the excuse that I saw in the paper was that there was a frost in Colombia, or Brazil, one or the other, Colombia or Brazil, and that it had ruined the coffee crop. And I said to myself, oh yeah, it ruined the coffee crop. Now let's see, coffee is only produced in Brazil and Colombia. Boys and girls, coffee is produced all over the world. And whether or not there's a frost in Bolivia or Colombia doesn't affect the price of coffee. The coffee producers got together and decided we're going to increase the price of coffee because it's too low, and I don't blame them. It was pretty low. We used to pay $6 a can. It went down to $4. Now, suddenly, the price goes up to $6, and you should see the opinions and the letters to the editors. As readers, you know, would castigate the coffee companies and the government and everybody because of this outrageous price increase in coffee. Now, at that time, I had about 200 cans sitting on my shelves. Did I complain? I didn't complain. I wasn't concerned about it. Why not? Well, I had 200 cans. A 200-can supply is approximately, I don't know, 10 or 15 years. What if every American had 200 cans of coffee on the shelf and the producers raised the price to $6 and we just stopped buying coffee the next morning, that's all? What difference does it make to us? It is this surplus that hangs over the marketplace which is the terror, that strikes terror in the hearts of big business. And that's why they put these, or one of the reasons, not the only, but one of the reasons that they put these dates on their products to discourage you from saving, to discourage you from stockpiling. Let me tell you a little story here. I'm going to move back here to chapter 5. And here's, well, I guess I'm going to move forward to chapter 5. Here we are. Prudent storage or hoarding. Nobody wants to be branded a hoarder, do they? I mean, you wouldn't want somebody to say, why, you hoarder? Well, W. Cleon Skousen, a noted writer and educator and former chief of police of Salt Lake City, made a profound statement to me regarding the morality of storing food. He said, quote, if you buy up food when there's plenty, that's food storage. If you wait until it's scarce, that's hoarding. Now, as of this writing, there is plenty of food readily available, albeit at rapidly increasing prices, as the impact of all of the problems is not really being felt yet. That was the former police chief of Salt Lake City. I think he's exactly correct. There's no shortage of coffee out there today, boys and girls. There's no shortages of anything, to my knowledge, here in the United States. I'll bet you Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders, and Western Europeans have got plenty out there available, but the day is coming. The day is coming, says the Scripture, says Moses, says God Almighty, when those surpluses are going to be turned to shortages. And then those shortages will be turned to desperation and then finally to famine. Now, when that happens, you're either going to have some stocks or you're not. And you got to make a choice. You know, you can stock up or you don't have to. If you're happy and satisfied with a 3-day supply and the food being kept by multinational corporations in warehouses down at Walmart, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But as for me and my house, I don't have a great deal of confidence in Walmart. I know they're nice guys, and they greet me when I come in the door with a big smile. But I'm not sure that Walmart, in conjunction with China and all of those suppliers, are always going to have in the warehouse all of the food, all of the supplies that all of us are going to need all of the time. So while there's plenty, I think I'll stock up on a couple of extra things. And I suggest that each and every one of you do the same. Because that's what mankind has been doing for thousands of years. We have always had a year-to-year supply. This concept of 3 days in the refrigerator is something that developed after 1950. Boys and girls, that's just 50 years old. And I say that that is a very risky thing to decide upon. Very risky. But if that's your decision, you know, get after it. Don't let me get in your way. But I'm not going to follow after that. And that's why I created a subsistence and survival school, not based upon guns and bullets and camouflage suits, but the practical day-to-day, everyday things that you need to live your life. And in the process, when it gets down to where there's barter, you've got some coffee to trade for some gasoline. You might need some gasoline for your chainsaw so that you can cut wood for the winter so that you can keep warm. And that's just where reality's at. And I don't know what the barter rate is going to be, but I want to have a couple of cans of coffee and a couple of bottles of vodka and maybe a couple of cases of beer on hand so that I can trade that to somebody else. All right, mull that one over, and we've got to take a little break here at the halfway point and give you a couple of reminders. Then we'll be back with more. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, just go to our website, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Howard J. Ruff. Let me tell you where this book might be found. It's called Famine and Survival in America. It's almost like the guy wrote the book last week. It's copyrighted 1974 by Howard J. Ruff. So if you were to go to a used bookstore asking for Famine and Survival in America, Howard J. Ruff, let's see what they come up with on the computer. It's not just ancient writing. It's almost like prophetic writing, and I don't subscribe to Mormon theology per se. I'm just suggesting the book because I've got it on my shelf. I read it back in the 70s, along with Brown's book on the coming economic collapse. And then it sure looked like that the writing was on the wall in 1973. Do you remember that? Some of you old-timers might remember that. Interest rates hit 21%, gold hit $800 an ounce, silver $50 an ounce, fiat currency. We had inflation like you couldn't believe. So what he's describing here actually took place in the 1970s. I was in the construction business. I could have bought every house in Boise, Idaho. There were literally hundreds of houses in Boise, Idaho that the banks had, that they'd repossessed from all the contractors around town. And they had them for sale for no money down. Hell, you could just go out there and take them. There wasn't enough money around there to maintain them, much less sell them. There wasn't any money available. So we thought that that was the end of it. Now, it wasn't. As it turned out, Paul Volcker and his program actually bailed the economy out one more time. Alan Greenspan did it one more time back in 1990. Remember that? All right. Now, so far, the Federal Reserve has always come in and always been able to bail it out, pump it up, get the balloon just a little bit bigger. Now, one of these days, that isn't going to work. I don't know when it is. I'm not a prophet, but I'm here to tell you that one of these days, it ain't going to work. Just like 1783, 1929, you know, that there comes a point in time when inevitably reality is going to strike us all. Now, we're on number 16. He says, individuals in rural areas will have a very difficult time living at subsistence levels. They'll need to have marketable commodities stored with which to barter for surplus food with those who are growing it. Individuals living in cities may not survive at all. Now, I'm going to pause right here and tell you that during the 1930s, my Aunt Bessie and Uncle Buster, who lived through it at that time, both of them born around the turn of the century, they were in their 30s, had young families. The people that had the toughest time during the Depression were those living in the cities. Those that had the easiest time were those living out in the country, on the land, where they could grow their own food. And that's what I'm suggesting to you. Three things you need: food, clothing, and shelter. Now, they were using flour sacks from the feed company as the material to make dresses for the women. Men wore bib overalls and high-top shoes. I mean, we looked like the Chinese of the 1940s and 50s. I mean, we all wore the same kind of clothes. Bib overalls and high-top shoes. We weren't wearing designer jeans, boys and girls. It was denim, but it wasn't designer. And we were glad to get what we had. Now, it would pay you to have a supply of food, clothing, and shelter on hand. The worst thing that can happen is that the world does not come to an end, and you can always use your food, your clothing, and your shelter as time progresses. And if you have a supply, you have a pantry, and that pantry has a 1-year supply, a 2-year supply, a 3-year supply, hell, you know, 1, 2, 3 weeks is better than 3 days. 3, 4 months is better than 2 or 3 weeks. A year or two is better than 3 or 4 months. And I've never met a Mormon yet that starved to death or went into bankruptcy because he had too much food stockpiled. I haven't met one yet. Now, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'm not even a Mormon. But the only people that write books and tell you how to do this are the Mormons. If there's anybody else, I don't know who it is. And that's because the Mormons took it seriously, and they got that from Young back in the 1870s, Brigham Young. And they've taken it to heart. Now, notice in recent years, they have declaimed that claim now that they're not stockpiling or storing food. I think it's because they're afraid that their neighbors are going to rape, rob, and pillage them and steal their food, and so I think they're kind of keeping it on the QT. But as I pointed out earlier, boys and girls, the logistics of keeping your pantry are so great that during the 30s and 40s, when people had pantries and there were people without pantries, you didn't find people running around sticking a gun in somebody's face and saying, "I'm going to steal your food," because you can only do it once. And food is so heavy that you'd need a truck and trailer to come and haul it away. That isn't going to work. You've either got it or you don't. And you're not going to take it from the guy next door. Well, not more than once. I mean, you might go over and stick a gun in his face and take his food once. What are you going to do tomorrow? What are you going to do next week, next month, next year? I mean, come on, boys and girls. We're talking about tons and tons and tons of food in stockpiles or in storage. We're not talking about, you know, a knapsack full. We're not talking about a grocery cart. I think the people that are talking about, oh, I know, I'll go rob the Mormons, I think they've got their heads up the wrong end of their anatomies, unable to count. They've been living from day to day and week to week out of the supermarkets for so long, they haven't got a handle on reality. And reality is, when I was a kid, it was a big project putting up a year's food during July, August, September, and October. Those 4 months were spent just putting the food together that you're going to eat for the next 8. Now, that's the way it was year after year after year. Now, today, we Americans spend all of our time watching the soaps on television and going to the air-conditioned malls or spending our time in the video arcades. And we've been doing that now for 40 or 50 years, but I would suggest to you that you start thinking more about what am I going to do to feed my family over the next 5, 10, 15 years. Number 17, he says, when the worst of the aftermath of runaway inflation has passed, barter may evolve to the point where exchanges become more frequent and more extended, covering longer distances and bigger trades. Commodities in especially high demand, such as food, cigarettes, and liquor, may be used as money, as individuals would accept them in exchange even if that individual did not intend to use them himself. He'll know that he can always trade them to someone else for something that he wants. They will have accepted value and be widely needed. This, of course, is the same way that money came into existence originally. Let me put my little mark here and tell you that's exactly what was going on in World War II. Everybody went down and they got all of their ration cards and coupons. Vegetarians got their ration cards and collected their meat and then traded their meat to some guy for something else. The guy that was getting extra gasoline was trading that gasoline to somebody else. That's what we call the black market. There will be a thriving black market. You can count on it. You can count on it. Now, eventually, however, a more useful trading medium will probably assert itself. Most likely coins of real gold or silver. As the coins feed through the community, a semblance of order will return. A durable money commodity is the lifeblood of civilization, making possible the specialization of labor, the ability of one person to employ another, and the opportunity to accumulate long-term savings. And so from the ashes of a dead civilization, a new civilization arises, painfully and slowly and probably fully prepared to make the same mistakes that eventually killed the older one. We didn't learn anything from 1783, and we didn't learn anything, boys and girls, from 1930. And I'm here to tell you that we're going to make that same fateful decision again. And there will be massive opportunities at profit. Massive. I mean, there's going to be so much property that's being traded back and forth, repossessed, taken away from those that can no longer make the payments. It'll be dirt cheap and there'll be lots of it out there. So if you've got real money to buy it, you're going to make some fantastic deals. Now, once step five has been reached, the economy is in for rough sledding. And no matter which choices the government makes thereafter, but if step 15 is reached, in which no valuable currency can replace the old one, the doom of the country is sealed. Which brings us up to survival first. Now, with such a scenario, survival becomes your first responsibility, and the protection of your family is your first concern. You need a safe place, adequate storable food for 1 to 5 years, and a supply of all of the commodities necessary for an orderly life. And you'll also need a medium of exchange. So I've chosen food as my medium of exchange. And after meeting my family's nutritional needs, I'll store in a safe place as much storable food as I can buy. And when our currency is worthless, I'll be able to barter that for something that I need. And I'm also following Brown's investment suggestions in foreign currency, gold and silver, but my emphasis is on food. Now, I've been suggesting that to my students over the past 20 years. I'm not sure that gold and silver is the end-all panacea that's being promoted. Now, I can readily see where gold and silver coin is important. I use gold and silver coin in my life today. I don't use Federal Reserve notes, commercial paper, mortgages, interest, etc. I don't charge usury. I don't practice it. But I think Brown's, that in this case it was a Ruff's conclusion, that food is the barter. Notice he uses 1 to 5 years. 1 to 5 years. Storable food. Now let me back up for a moment. Let me tell you a story here about the most storable food is not canned food, it's dried food. Dried. The foods that last the longest, I mean, you know, like grains, beans, you know, wheat, corn, beans, those things last for thousands of years kept dry. Thousands of years. They don't have a shelf life of a year or 2 years or 5 years. That's nonsense. That's multinational corporate business putting a label or a date on a package to convince you that you can't store it or that you ought to throw what you've got out. If you want to follow that, get after it. I'm not throwing any of my long-term food storage away because it's got a date on it. In fact, I'll tell you a little story here. The wife came in the other day and she had about 25 bottles of French's mustard. And in anticipation of doing this series of programs here, I noted that the expiration date on these 25 or 30 jars of mustard is February. In fact, I got one right here. It's February 18th, 2005. Now, as I speak, this is July the 4th, 2005. So they're already 4 months expired. Now, look at the number one ingredient that's in mustard. Did you notice that it's vinegar? Vinegar. Vinegar is not something that deteriorates. Vinegar is something that you use to preserve food. It's a preservative. It's like formaldehyde. Do you think that formaldehyde has a shelf life? What do you think that vinegar is going to turn into? Wine? Did you think that vinegar is going to turn back into apple juice? You know, vinegar is the end product. Now, the fact that this is 4 months, it says best if used by February 18th, 2005. Okay. Well, the French people over there put that label on there, and it'll persuade most people to throw that out. It must be no good. That helps them sell more mustard, doesn't it? So I came along, and I paid, well, the wife did. She paid 25 cents a bottle. Now, this stuff is 89 cents in the store. She paid 25 cents. You want to know how you're going to finance your food storage program? Buy the out-of-date stuff. And what's the shelf life on mustard? Hell, I got mustard out there. It's been on the shelf for 10 years. 10 years that I know of. Now, come on, boys and girls. Most of this food that has labels and dates on it doesn't expire, and it doesn't wear out, and it doesn't spoil. Now, it's true that some will, and if you don't know how to store it, now, it'll probably spoil on you. And canned food, wet canned food, you know, like cans of pumpkin? Well, first of all, a can of pumpkin only has 20% of its food value left. Why don't you get dried pumpkin? Dried. It keeps its enzymes and it keeps its food value for years and years. Decades and decades. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do that, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package first? And then let me tell you how, you know, I can only scratch the tip of the iceberg here. But, you know, I mentioned to you in the last program, you know, peanut butter. Processed peanut butter, unopened. Jif peanut butter, 2 years? Nonsense. Peanut butter will keep forever in a closed container. Keep the oxygen away from it, keep forever. I wouldn't buy Jif peanut butter, but I think if you bought natural peanut butter that separates, now, I know that that stuff keeps 10 or 15 years. I've got some out there right now. I buy it in 5-gallon buckets over here at East Wind. East Wind Peanut Butter Company. All right, now, I can't tell you all the answers here over the air, so if you think that you've gotten all of the story in this series of programs, I think that you're going to starve to death and be sadly mistaken. But we teach a class that has 20 lessons or 20 chapters, 20 things that you need to know. And it isn't just food. Food is just one element, one item out of 64 life-threatening problems. And all I'm talking about this week is famine. Disease is another big one. God has killed more people with disease than he has with famine. And you're going to find more people dying from disease in this upcoming Great Tribulation than die from hunger and starvation. Hunger and starvation set you up for the disease. Very few people are actually going to die from starving to death. They're going to weaken their bodies, and then they're going to die from some disease before they can starve. I mean, that's the way the game is played. Now, there's one more book here I want to share with you because you got about 10 minutes left here. This is actually a manual. It's called the Don't Get Caught With Your Pantry Down. Don't Get Caught With Your Pantry Down is the name of the book, written by James Stevens. And he's got a page in here that says, go to the ant and consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long will you sleep, and when will you arise out of your sleep? Proverbs 6, verses 6 through 9. This proverb, go to the ant, you sluggard, and learn of her ways, gave rise to this old nursery rhyme or this old story of the ant and the grasshopper. Remember, the grasshopper is out here fiddling and having a good time, and the ant is out here working hard in the summertime to provide, and then pretty soon the grasshopper comes to the ant and says, hey, give me some food because it's cold and I don't have any food. And the ant says, you should have stockpiled your food in the summertime, you fool, now go die. And that's what happens. The ants live from year to year, and the grasshoppers die, and they have to come out with the new hatching in the spring. And so there's just a proverb there, and this guy put that down. I thought it was kind of prophetic in its nature. You can get a copy of this book probably from the publisher. Now, I'm talking about a manual. This thing is it's not 8.5 by 11, but it's big. It must be 8.5 wide and probably 8.5 tall. Don't Get Caught With Your Pantry Down. Let me see if I can give you a place to... Historical Publications. Historical Publications Incorporated. 15705 Hillcroft Cove, Austin, Texas, 78717. Telephone number is 800-880-6789. Again, that's 800-880-6789. Historical Publications Incorporated, 15705 Hillcroft Cove, Austin, Texas, 78717. Now, in looking at the table of contents over here, I don't know how many pages are in here. Let me look and see if they got page numbers. Well, each section's got page numbers. Look, this is the Preparedness Marketplace, page 169, and then there's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of those. My guess is that this manual probably has 600-700 pages in it. And it's got sources from or to which you can go to get certain commodities. Now, if you want long-term storage, you can have this stuff nitrogen-packed in 5-gallon buckets. And remember, I told you that dried food is better because it stores longer, keeps its nutrition. You get about 100% nutrition out of dried food. You get 80% out of cooked food or canned food. Now, this dried food, you need 171 5-gallon buckets. It takes a space 4 feet wide, 8 feet long, and 8 feet high for a 4-year supply for a family of 4. So, a closet, 4 feet wide, 8 feet long, 8 feet high, that's standard ceiling height, 6 buckets high. They're about 15-16 inches each. And you can store a 4-year supply of food in the form of beans, lentils, rice, corn, and so on. And it'll cost you about $3,000, about 50 cents a pound. Now, how much do you need? You need approximately 1 pound of dried food per person per day. 1 pound per person per day. That's about 1,500 pounds for a 4-year supply for one person. Take 4 people, that's 6,000 pounds at 50 cents a pound. You know, roughly $3,000. Now, don't tell me that $3,000 is just out of the question. You know, we spend more money than that on cigarettes and booze. You know, if you're a smoker, you're spending $3 a day minimum on cigarettes. $3 a day. Now, you take that same $3 a day, and let's take that $6,000 and divide that by 3, and you need 2,000 days divided by 365. You'd have approximately 5 years of non-smoking, and you could pay that, only needed $3,000, about 2.5 years. 3,000 divided by 3, that's 1,000 divided by 365 is less than 3 years, 2.75 years. If you quit smoking in 3 years, you'd have your food storage program. So when I hear people say, well, I couldn't afford that, you spend more money than that chasing around buying gasoline, for crying out loud. I was talking to a guy the other day. He goes down to Mountain Home about twice a week. I mentioned that to you. I've got a van out here, and my van, you know, when I go to Mountain Home, gets 15 miles to the gallon. It's 40 miles down there. 15, 30, 45, 3 gallons down, 3 gallons back, at 6 gallons at $2. That's $12 to drive to Mountain Home, for crying out loud. Now, why don't you plan your time a little better? Instead of going to Mountain Home once a week, why don't you go once a month and save the $36 and spend that on wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, and I think you'll be glad that you did. So that's the way you finance that. You give up something over here that you don't need, can't use, and shouldn't have anyway. All right, we got one more program. Next program I'm going to take up, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. I'll show you what God has to say about this thing of famine, the great tribulation, along with Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. I'll run through some of these key prophecies here. Now, you know, Noah's flood only happened one time. One time. In fact, it's the only time that he's ever destroyed mankind with water, with a flood. He said, I'll never do that again. But he says, I'm going to do it again. And I'm going to do it with this great tribulation. Here's what I'm going to do. And he lays out the step-by-step sequence of events. Now, Noah had 120 years to prepare. We've had about 3,000 years to prepare. And every generation should be ready and prepared for the second coming. Every generation, every 40 years, we should be prepared. He said, this generation will not pass until all of these things be fulfilled. Now, one of these days, that generation, is it going to be our generation, or it's going to be my children's generation, or their children's generation at some point in time? And when the famine hit in Egypt, they either had the food or they didn't. Now, Joseph stockpiled a 7-year supply. The Messiah said that all these things happened as examples for us to learn by. Now, that famine in Egypt during Joseph's time is an example for you to learn by. Noah's flood is an example for you to learn by. God's a nice guy, and he's very patient. But there comes a point in time when he flies off the handle, bounces off the ceiling, and goes ballistic on us. And when he does, a lot of people are going to get hurt in the process. And when that happens, you want to get the hell out of the road. It's kind of like the old man, you know, coming after baby brother with his belt. That's not the time for you to get in Dad's way. You know, let baby brother take his medicine, and you go get out of Dad's road. All right, we're just about out of time. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. So let me give you a reminder as we leave the air. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, my producer says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station for the conclusion. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.